When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. is here. And we will be talking about this idea of LDL, low density lipoprotein denialism. So just for a quick little background, it became pretty cemented that these LDL little particles, the little particles that carry the cholesterol in our blood, are causally associated. They cause atherosclerosis and therefore atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which includes heart disease and all the very similar.
Strokes and et cetera. Plaque, as people know it.
This wasn't just like, oh, there's just one study and yeah, it looks like this is the cause. There's been multiple reviews on this. It started with what's called epidemiology, which is more observational, just watching people over time and seeing different risk, you know, things that they eventually developed as risk factors or identified as risk factors over time. And one of them was cholesterol, total cholesterol. And then they found that, hey, it kind of depends on what's carrying the cholesterol. And one of them being these little, specifically these LDL or low density lipoprotein particles carrying the cholesterol. And it seemed to be that those who have higher amounts of those had more risk of cardiovascular disease. And over time, then eventually we started getting treatments for this to see if lowering that actually helped with reducing risk. And it did. At first we had, bile acid sequestrants. and then they had fibrates and eventually
some early trials, even with niacin,
the coronary drug project. People listening to this don't really care. Then all of a sudden statins come in and boom, multiple different types of statins. Statins are these drugs that basically block this enzyme in specifically, we want to block it more so in the liver, the rate limiting step of cholesterol synthesis. And what it does is, most people think it blocks the synthesis of cholesterol, so we have less of it in our blood, but it actually helps with the uptake in our liver, the recycling of LDL particles. So if you stop the synthesis or making up cholesterol, your liver's like, hey, we need to get more in. So it starts opening up the little receptors to bring of these LDL particles in. So these statins
from
come
the
out.
Bloodstream. Yeah. Well, and actually the same, that's the same as those bile acid sequestrants. Essentially,
yeah,
we'd lose these LDL, LDL cholesterol, thus lowering the particles, blah, blah, blah. And then the liver would open it up and, hey, yeah, come back in here because we need more.
Yeah, we need more cholesterol. So Through the years, then all, people were like, okay, well, maybe it's something else about the statins. They seem to have what they call pleiotropic effects other than the LDL cholesterol lowering. Well, it's been pretty clear that it looks like the amount of cholesterol they lower, it actually decreases the risk along the same line. Newer drugs come out, something called ezetimibe, which blocks the uptake of the absorption of dietary and intestinal cholesterol, very important. That's whatever's in your intestines, blocks that. And that's the same kind of thing as the bile acid sequestrants. All these things upregulate the liver's ability to take the LDL into your liver and get it out of your blood. But so we have randomized controlled trials showing this and decreasing risk. We have epidemiological, but also the other component of it is the genetics, which is kind of what spurred this conversation today.
Yeah, so we'll come around to this.
This is what really got me. So I personally went down the rabbit hole of like, well, gosh,
you know. You do tend to go down rabbit holes more than I have historically done.
Yeah, but that's
because you push the limits once in a while.
Well,
and no, because not because you're more open-minded.
No, I'm way more open-minded.
Nope, you're more you're more gullible. Nope,
way more open-minded.
Yep, less.
Way more.
Go gullible.
So
you once thought adrenal fatigue was possibly a thing.
No, I did not. I think it was real.
You were in med school.
I thought it was.
Yep. Nope.
My adrenals were fatigued at one point.
When I was a resident, you were a med student. You told me to cut down on my coffee drinking because I was going to fatigue my adrenal glands.
Because your adrenals were going to fail. At that moment.
All right.
I mean, you looked like it.
Definitely look like it now.
Yeah, that's for other reasons. But okay, so but these people make very good points because observational
because
studies
it is a complex disease, right? that's part of it is we're going to talk about how these atherogenic, literally they're called atherogenic lipoproteins, are the foundational cause of atherosclerosis. But there are so many other factors in this. It's similar or analogous to some of these other things we talk about, like obesity and diabetes. It's not just black and white, but people love to make it black and white.
Yeah. So the pathogenesis of cardiovascular disease or atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, I should say, and we've talked about a little bit this before when we talked about the steroids and how they can have various changes in your endothelial and whatever. But the basics are these little particles that carry the cholesterol. It's not the cholesterol itself. They need particles, these protein particles to carry the cholesterol. It would be like oil trying to be in water and see how it separates out. Cholesterol lipids need to be, they're not water soluble. So they need these little protein particles. And so these little particles get into the inside of your artery lining, and it starts this whole immune cascade where these little particles get trapped. They get, whether they get oxidized, modified in some other way, and your immune system comes out, tries to gobble it, and they develop these little foam cells, and eventually cholesterol starts building up, and that's how you start developing plaque. And some of these can become unstable. It gets into the blood, causes a clot to form. You have a heart attack type of thing. Anyway, there are people that have been very skeptical of this, and rightfully so. These things go through multifactorial things can be very hard to pinpoint.
Yeah. And we're always learning more. And this is where people in the lay public get really frustrated with science. They say, "Well, but the CDC said this," and then they change their mind. Well, that's what happens when you learn and then you try to change guidance. These things do change. So healthy skepticism is good, especially in science, and everyone should acknowledge that.
So right? I read a lot of these skeptic books, and some of them made a lot of sense. So one of them specifically, because the hang-up that I had was, it was in 2000, I believe, in 12 or 10, somewhere around there, I was reading this book, and it was they talked about the statin trial that added ezetimibe. I don't remember if it was the ENHANCE trial, whatever it was. And unfortunately, they use a surrogate marker of atherosclerosis called CIMT.
Yeah, that was ENHANCE.
Yeah. So carotid intimal media thickness. It was basically looking at the thickness of your carotid, since not actually looking at atherosclerosis or heart attack events.
You just pointed to your neck, but nobody watches us.
Oh yeah, sorry. Anyway, that marker has thus been shown to not be that reliable of a marker for outcomes. Mm-hmm. So they added statins or they added ezetimibe, the thing that blocks cholesterol uptake into your intestines, along with a statin. And the people's LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol and everything went down, but it didn't look like it changed this CIMT very well. Well, so why would that happen? If we're lowering LDL cholesterol, why wouldn't they have improved outcomes? Well, the unfortunate thing is that the outcome that they were measuring was flawed, because it was later on then, finally, the IMPROVE IT trial came out and actually did show that adding ezetimibe to a statin lowered events. And on top of that, they started getting, over these past few years, they started getting so good at looking at the genetics, to where I went to one of these lipid conferences because I was really interested in it. And they showed those who had the lowest genetically, by the way, those who genetically have lower cholesterol, just based on their genetics, have fewer events, than otherwise not having those genetics, then those people had genetics that had higher levels, and not just what we call like monogenic. We talked about the differences between monogenic and polygenic obesity. There's the same thing with LDL cholesterol and lipids.
There's so many different little factors as to how these things are regulated, and there can be genetic mutations in each of these. And this is what we're ultimately going to talk about, because these really, really kind of lay it out nicely.
Yeah. So when I went to this conference, and I was kind of skeptical back then, and they showed the genetics pretty well, that I was like, if you have lower amounts, just by luck of the genetic lottery, you have fewer cardiovascular events. You have higher amounts, you had more cardiovascular events. And it was like, wow, plus these trials. And then all of a sudden we have these newer drugs coming out called these PCSK9 inhibitors, that they're another way of upregulating the liver's ability to take these little particles out of the blood. Yeah. And it seems like very a slam powerful. Dunk, but there are still these people that are extremely skeptical, to where it's like, man, I think you have to be pretty crazy to be skeptical about this. Well, but they come up with some interesting points. Yeah. But
And the other thing is that they're not just skeptical, though. They're just straight up trying to buck whatever the scientific consensus
contrarian.
Is. They're contrarians because they're trying to usually sell something. And they're often
some
keto zealots, and they're trying to get everyone to drink butter and eat ribeyes every single day, and they think that their LDL and, you know, ApoB containing lipoproteins, which I don't think we got into that yet. But
no, we didn't talk. It doesn't really matter.
They think
at this
they
point.
Don't matter. But you know, to your point though, when you're talking about when you went to that conference that you're talking about, was it around the time of the IMPROVE-IT trial results?
Around that, it was before this, it was before that. So it was before that. So when all these things combined,
you know, it is
2014, I think.
Yeah, so in 2015 was when the IMPROVE-IT trial results finally came out. And to be fair, it was pretty subtle, right? It took 7 years to show statistically significant event reduction. And this also gets complicated by, you know, dietary cholesterol, how much dietary cholesterol even influences our lipoproteins and that sort of thing. And everyone's different, right? And so then what they showed was it took 7 years for it to show anything in general, and it was all driven by those who had type 2 diabetes and established already atherosclerotic disease. So probably those people had, you know, whatever factors where dietary cholesterol really was the problem. But it helped us know, well, which people should we really be considering adding this to? And also the statin wasn't that powerful that they were using. It was simvastatin. None of us ever use that one anymore, right?
No, I don't use that.
But more importantly, to your point is, and I just happen to have this in a slide for giving a talk on a dietary cholesterol talk. At the same time, in the same New England Journal of Medicine publication, they had the study results from some genetics of the Niemann-Pick receptor, which is where the ezetimibe works. And so they have the association between presence of inactivating mutations. So we talk a lot about these inactivating mutations of these things, of the Niemann-Pick receptor and the plasma lipid levels. So they show that, you know, total cholesterol was down, you know, by about 13 milligrams per deciliter, LDL lipoproteins down by about 12, and actually HDL was a hint up by 2 milligrams per deciliter. They also had a 12% reduction in triglycerides, and we haven't gotten into that, and that probably is for another podcast. But then what they did was then they talked about the association between the presence of this inactivating mutation, and we just said the lipid levels, and the risk of coronary heart disease. And essentially across the board, it was just, you know, just dramatically reduced compared to everyone else. And that sort of was, you know, one of the bigger news sort of genetic association studies that we learned about.
Yeah. So a lot of these, basically for me, what sold it to me was, okay, we could probably, you know, spin our way around observational epidemiological data, because I understand, you know, there could be associations that aren't causal. The RCTs are pretty strong. They've gotten
pretty
only stronger.
Good.
We're going to have
even
stronger ones.
But
we're stronger, you know, ones are coming out. We have
but there are reasons to be, you know, skeptical a little bit, I guess, of those.
there's another. So the skeptics will say that these drugs have off-target effects that lower cardiovascular events. That has nothing to do with the LDL particles,
and that's
cholesterol.
That term that you used, pleiotropic effects. Other good things that happen.
So they first started with statins because statins seem to have an anti-inflammatory effect. So like it's just the anti-inflammatory effect. That's what's doing. And if you think about how these particles get into the artery. So we talked about there's other components of atherosclerosis. These particles get into the arteries, start this immunological cascade. Now, the thing is, though, if you have more inflammation, and I have these different analogies, you can talk about how the particles are the boats and the cholesterol on the particles are the cargo. And when you deliver these, you know, cargo boats all over the place, they can get caught into the harbor. And so people that have good bumpers on their harbor, they don't bump in and crash. That's having good endothelial, the lining of your arteries. That's good. If you're good and healthy, you're exercising, you're eating a good healthful diet, getting good sleep, not super stressed out. You don't have adrenal fatigue like my brother. I'm just joking. But anyway, you have good healthy endothelium. When you start getting inflammation, chronic inflammation, you smoke, you are not getting a lot of good sleep. You have high elevated adiposity that's increasing
inflammation and everything else.
And that actually can damage your endothelium, and these particles can more readily be taken up and then modified, oxidized within there. And then your immune system, there's components within there that also can increase the uptake of these particles and then start the atherosclerotic cascade, and then the stability of those plaques and everything else. And then also another thing to point out is that some of these skeptics will say, well, why don't you get atherosclerosis in your veins? Like, why is it just in your arteries? Well, blood pressure can also have an effect. The turbulent
blood
flow.
Pressure is a huge effect.
That's the reason why.
And this is why we talk about all these different cardiovascular risk factors when we think about an individual's cardiovascular risk, and at what point do we want to treat all these things? And we talk about those, you know, the risk factors and treating their lipids, their blood pressure, which is huge. We have huge amounts of data to show that blood pressure reduction improves cardiovascular events. So it's not like, you know, we're living in a vacuum with just LDL, even though LDL particles are the foundational driving factor of atherosclerosis.
They start the cascade.
They're needed to do this.
Yes. Anyway, my analogy would be like there are other components and there's other things that can accelerate the risk of atherosclerosis.
But your little harbor, you got some little asshole like you on a jet ski driving around and screwing somebody up, and then they crash into the dock, and then they're stuck.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it would be on a jet ski. My jet ski would be sinking.
You'd be sinking. I'd be in a sailboat screwing something up and running into somebody.
Making somebody else actually go into the harbor wall. So anyway, the turbulent flow makes a difference. And you know, some of these skeptics come up with good points. Why don't some people with high LDL cholesterol develop atherosclerosis? Well, you know, some of those things are very interesting. We have people that have, you know, high, we consider 190 and above is like a reason you need to treat, because it's assumed that they have something called familial hypercholesterolemia, which goes back to the genetics. It's a monogenic defect in one of their major components that control their serum cholesterol levels. It can be an issue with the LDL receptor, that thing that recycles directly on the liver. It could be the PCSK9,
which
could, ApoB, it could be actually the formation of the particle and just not being taken up. Well, some of these people have very high LDL cholesterol levels, and the skeptics bring up some good points. Like, why don't all those people develop atherosclerosis? Well, there's probably some other components about them that make them what I would say resilient to the atherosclerosis. It doesn't guarantee you're going to get atherosclerosis. However,
the people with homozygous FH.
Homozygous. I don't know of a single case.
No, they get coronary heart disease when they're young, very, very young. Like,
these people have LDL cholesterol levels 500, 600, 1,000, so very high.
they die early if they don't get very specialized intensive treatment.
So these are rare. So my brother's talking about these, the homozygous, they have not only one defect in their genes, they have two defects that are basically your liver has no ability to take up these LDL particles. And so they just sit around and then just get into your arteries, and you can see people start getting xanthomas and also basically cholesterol deposits around the body. Those people, the kids, it's very sad. They can get atherosclerosis before the age of 10 often. And I don't know of anybody that knows of anybody with untreated, at least untreated FH that hasn't developed cardiovascular disease within the first two decades of or three decades of life, I believe. I passed around different cardiologists.
I mean, it's such a rare thing. I mean, it's generally going to be, you know, they're going to do genetic screening of all the families and stuff like that when it's like this. I mean, this is rare and severe, but.
So it brings us up to this study that just came out. We have these, I'm friends with a lot of these cardiologists on Twitter. You know, I've never met them in person. We're tweeter friends, and they come out with these. It's really interesting. Really interesting stuff, because I was a skeptic at one point. I was like, I don't know about this, but at this point, like, I don't know how anybody could even question it. I think you got
to
be
and that's why I say it's like they're just being contrarian and trying to, you know, go against whatever, you know, they want to be on the Joe Rogan show, and they all want to make money by trying to trick everybody, I think, because it makes no sense.
I guarantee you there's listeners right now that have had their physician or whoever say, hey, you really need to lower your cholesterol. And you're like, really? Do I need to? We're going to have a series on, like, let's go over the basic lipid panel. We're not going to do that here. We're just going
and
over
cardiovascular risk and all that stuff. But
we're just going over this concept of just denial of this very powerful concept. And I don't think you should deny it. You should at least we're making you aware that, like, hey, this does matter. It's not something you just should ignore. So what is the study that just came out?
All right. And then we can circle back to some of the, you know, the genetic stuff. So basically, you know, you talked about the PCSK9 and the apolipoprotein B, you know, genes, right? So apolipoprotein B is the protein that's on all of these atherogenic lipoproteins. PCSK9, is the enzyme that breaks down the receptors that goes out. And so if we inhibit it, you have more receptors go out and lower your LDL. And so the question for this study that was just published a couple days ago is, what's the prevalence of these are called protein truncating variants, nobody cares about that, in the ApoB or the PCSK9 genes and their association with the LDL, specifically in this case, LDL cholesterol. And we want to emphasize that we want to talk about the low density lipoproteins that matter more than the actual cholesterol in them. And then with the coronary heart disease. And so, you know, it's a genetic association study. It had almost 20,000 US participants and almost 200,000 United Kingdom participants. And these were only identified in 0.4% of the individuals, by the way. But the estimated untreated LDL was about 32% to 37% lower in these protein truncating variant carriers versus the non-carriers. So this is kind of, we can talk about what these Mendelian randomization studies are, but basically it's like kind of we're randomized at birth, right? We're randomized because some people have them, some people don't. And those reduced LDL levels were associated with a 49% reduction in the coronary heart disease risk. That's dramatic and in line with the randomized controlled trials that we have. And so, you know, so that's where these start to really, really kind of hammer down the foundation. So, you know, we talk about how the association between the LDL or what we'll talk about more later is non-HDL and ApoB and the risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, all those studies that we have, they're very strong, they're reproducible, we have meta-analyses, but they're still not randomized trials. And that's where people can pinpoint all the potential problems with them. And we know we have other things in science where we think this is the case because of the observational data, and then it turns out not, right? Like when we do an intervention. And so the Mendelian randomization studies, it's a scheme to essentially introduce randomization into like an observational study, like these, like what we just talked about. And so then, you know, it basically, looks at the exposure and an outcome, and it shows it to likely be causal.
Right. So in these cases, they looked at the certain genes that decreased these LDL particles and then looked at their risk over time. Yeah. And it's like, hey, the people that have these genes had lower risk. Yeah. And these keep coming out. It's very strong.
And it goes back to, like we said, with the Niemann-Pick receptor and the ezetimibe. And by the way, all these little things, this is how we end up getting therapies.
Yeah, this is how this is how a lot of these PCSK9 inhibitors specifically, people that had these PCSK9 mutations where they had less of it and fewer particles lifelong, lived nice long lives with fewer incidents of cardiovascular disease.
I wish I had those genes.
Yeah,
we have these Mendelian scores for the HMG CoA reductase inhibitor enzyme,
which is for
the same as what statins work on, right? Okay, and it shows very similar reduction of LDL and events, just like statins. We talked about the Niemann-Pick that has the genetic background, and then the ezetimibe, and then there's all the PCSK9 inhibitor enzymes and the PCSK9 just enzymes themselves. And then we have the PCSK9 inhibitor medications, right? Or we have medications that actually stop it from being
the
created.
The production,
right? Yeah, the production of it. The apolipoprotein B production. And that's, significant. And we do have a medicine that probably neither one of us have ever used, because that's for some of those really, really rare, homozygous levels. I think it's only indicated for that, as I recall. I mean, I used to do.
I'm not even sure if it's on the market anymore.
it's a rare, treatment. I think then there's the bile acid sequestration stuff. There's the LDL receptor ones. And it's just so consistent. And I think something, and maybe what we should do is post with this, that graph.
Yeah.
And I'll try to explain it. But there's, there's this graph in one of the more recent statements from the European Society of Cardiology that show along the X and Y axis comparing the proportional reduction in risk of coronary heart disease with the magnitude of exposure to the LDL for all these different things, randomized controlled trials, those prospective cohort, like observational studies that we talked about, and now, I would say most powerfully, the Mendelian randomization studies, and they all just kind of line up. So the lower the LDL, the higher the reduction, the more the reduction in the coronary heart disease. I mean, it's fantastic.
Right. It doesn't matter if it's observational. It doesn't matter if it's genetically found. It doesn't matter if it's a randomized controlled trial. These all pretty much line up. There are some nuances in there because it depends on how you lower the cholesterol, potentially the LDL cholesterol, and some of those other things. And some of these drugs can have what's called offshoot effects where it actually can kill somebody. So sooner.
Yeah. Medications have potential side effects. That's why they have such rigorous trials. And some things, if you would have asked us probably 10 years ago, was it 10 years ago when we were all into the CETP inhibitors? We thought, oh, these are going to be the next thing.
It was more than 10 years ago now.
Jeez, oh my God. Well, so anyways, and that got into the whole HDL, the alleged good cholesterol.
Yeah.
And, and everyone thought, well, raising that's going to do even better than just lowering, LDL. And it turned out that that was not the case.
Yeah.
There was no benefit, and there was a lot of harm because of other problems. So, medications are medications. There's pros and cons, risks, side effects. But these genetic studies are just so powerfully, educational, I think, for anybody worried.
In fact, we should get the cardiologist, we should get Dr. Sek on here, the guy who from Verve, he actually founded a company and they're going in and actually genetically modifying people who have some of these really debilitating genetics that increase the risk of cardiovascular.
Yeah, the opposite of what we've been kind of talking about, the more along lines of the familial hypercholesterolemia stuff like that.
They go in and edit people's genes, which is absolutely insane to me how they can do this. But they go in and do that, and I don't know what the outcome
is. Is that
be
getting there. into the CRISPR stuff?
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's nuts. So, all right. So the takeaway from this, we threw out a lot of terms this isn't supposed to be a masterclass of learning the physiology and pathophysiology of all of cardiovascular disease and lipoproteins.
But we can link to these two really good consensus statements for anybody who really wants to nerd it out and read it.
I've done lots of courses on this. It took me years to understand this stuff. So I don't think anybody is going to be listening to this and going, oh, I get it now. Here's the gist. Lower LDL cholesterol particles longer for most of your life equals less chance of cardiovascular disease. This does not mean other factors don't matter. This doesn't mean you can smoke. This doesn't mean you don't have to pay attention to your blood sugars. This doesn't mean
obesity, hypertension, inflammatory diseases, increased risk. Lots of different things contribute.
And then real quick, I know there are going to be people to say that, but I know people that died because their cholesterol was low. I'm talking about intentional, either whether from genetics or intentional lowering of their cholesterol. When people's cholesterol, specifically LDL or total cholesterol, start lowering without the person trying to, that means probably bad things are happening.
Yeah, it's not the cholesterol that's the problem. That's a sign of a problem.
Underlying either malnutrition, malignancy, cancers, that type of thing. In fact, I've seen that a few times where like, uh-oh. And some people had colon cancer and other things. And those people are not, forget about cardiovascular disease. They're going to die from something else. I'm not trying to be morbid. It's just that's the case. So
those are red flags of something else that's wrong.
And we call that reverse causation. So when people look at these observationals, sometimes you see this J shape or U shape curve of like, hey, it looks like people with really low cholesterol die, as much, if not more, than people with really high cholesterol. It's like bad things are happening to that person. But when you look at the genetics of it, people that intentionally or genetically have lower cholesterol, they do better over long term.
You said something in that little conclusion that was important that we didn't really get to is the time of exposure.
Yeah.
So the area under the curve it's kind of like pack years in smoking, right? So that we call it, I think we call it LDL years, right? People like to use that term.
Yeah, that's what they're doing.
So
plaque years.
Plaque years. So if you are born with one of these genetic mutations that reduces your LDL and your risk, well, you have a lot longer to have low atherogenic lipoproteins. If you wait till you're, 40, 50, 60, depending on your cardiovascular risk to start a statin, well, you have less time to, really reduce further progression or any type of progression of plaque, which then gets into a whole debate on,
when should we start?
How low should we go? That's a whole nother thing. How low should we go and for how long? And to be fair, I mean, there are certainly points of limiting returns and we don't want to take meds if we don't have
drugs.
To.
Right. Yes, so, exactly. Potentially.
So that's where it is. These are not simple little things.
No.
They take, really individualized, personalized consideration.
Statins and whatever should be in the water just yet anyway.
We've joked about when they come up with this sort of, isn't it a PCSK9? It's almost like a vaccination, right?
Yeah.
Like once a year to just basically kill off our PCSK9s. And we're like, I don't know. We'll volunteer for that study.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it.
Sounds pretty good.
I could do it. I might do it.
Lower
our
LDLs to nothing.
And I can do it if I want. All right. So if anybody has, we're probably going to do a Q&A podcast here soon. So we'll post and let everybody ask some questions. We're going to have we could get Dr. Dayspring. We could get a few other really smart lipidologists. So I did my lipidology boards. I'm technically a board certified lipidologist. My brother's an endocrinologist, knows it pretty well. There are some other like lecturers who do this for a living that we might get on here that could simplify the process even a little bit more.
Especially for a Q&A. This would be a great one for a Q&A. We might get a million questions.
Yeah, very good. All right. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
With the $5 meal deal at McDonald's, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Price and participation may vary for a limited time only.